This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And you are listening to KBOO in Portland. KBOO Portland. Where the time is approximately 9:01 a.m. Coming up this morning at 10 here, Chris Andre with, hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, more on how and why the NSA is keeping track of the telephone habits of Americans. Also, more on the Bradley Manning trial and more on Obama's nomination of Samantha Powers to be the next U.S. ambassador to the U.N. At 11, Shahid Hamid hosts It Takes a Village. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Robin Shanti interviews Michael O'Connor of Creative Collaborations about Hump Day, a monthly art and music festival held in Portland's Central East Side Industrial District. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for APA Compass, coming right up.
Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. APA Compass airs the first Friday of each month at 9 a.m. Today, we feature three authors and storytellers. Award-winning author and filmmaker Ruth Ozeki speaks with Marie Lowe about her latest novel, A Tale for the Time Being, which brings together themes and personalities from Tokyo and British Columbia. Also, author and storyteller C.P. Chang talks with Andrew Yeh about the challenges of interracial relationships and the challenges of telling those stories. C.P. is with the Chicago storytelling collective Second Story and a contributor to the anthology Briefly Knocked Unconscious by a Low-Flying Duck. But first, APA Award and Pushcart Prize-winning author Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni talks with Sarika Mehta about her latest novel, Oleander Girl, and how she portrays the complex mixture of the contemporary and the traditional, which is found in today's India.
Thanks for tuning in to APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta. Back in April, I had the privilege of chatting with award-winning writer Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni. She lives in Houston, Texas, hails from Calcutta, India, and spent her graduate school years at the University of California at Berkeley. Chitra's accolades include publishing a number of best-selling novels, such as Sister of My Heart and her award-winning collection of stories, Arranged Marriage. She recently published her latest novel, Oleander Girl, which tells the story of a Bengali girl from a traditional family who comes upon a family secret that leads her to the United States and a post-9/11 world. Chitra stopped in Portland on her book tour and chatted with me at KBOO. We began our conversation on writing from the perspective of her own various identities and making her work accessible to a wider audience.
Well, I believe, and this comes out of my experience as a reader, that if it's a good story And you've created a strong character, and you've really brought details of the setting to life that readers can connect across cultures. You know, readers are pretty smart that way. If they're emotionally engaged, they'll make a lot of leaps. So I just try to create a strong story. I try to create interesting characters who are in interesting situations, often situations of conflict. And then I just let the story take over and take me where it has to go. And I find that that is not a problem for readers. When I do events, I see that my events are split. They're about 50-50, people from South Asian origins and people who are not. And everyone seems to understand. So I have great faith in the intelligence of readers and in the power of imagery, because I think when those things come together, an experience is created and a lot of things are understood. Just kind of at the heart level.
Our conversation moved to inspiration, specifically what inspired the story behind Oleander Girl and why this experience was so unique to her other novels.
You know, Oleander Girl was an unusual book for me because it took several years to write. With a lot of my other books, I can distinctly remember the moment when the inspiration for the book came to me. But with Oleander Girl, I've been thinking about these ideas for a long, long time. So the book kind of seeped into me. And one of the major ideas in Oleander Girl is the clash between the old and the new, which I see in India so much. Every time I visit, India's moving so fast. It's rushing headlong to take its rightful place in the 21st century. And as it does that, there's so many changes and innovations and so much technology and a faster lifestyle. But also, there's a traditional part of India, thousands of years old culture, and all of that is very important to India as well. And those things are clashing. They're in conflict with each other. So in Oleander Girl, I try to show that conflict between Kaurabi, our protagonist, our female protagonist, who comes from a very old Bengal family, very prestigious. Like, the street outside her home is named after her great-grandfather, right? And she falls in love with Rajut, who is very much new India. You know, they're new money, they're looking ahead, they're internet savvy, their business is art, selling art. They've opened this huge gallery in Manhattan. So it's in their relationship is that clash between the old and the new. And as you can imagine, they're attracted to each other because of their differences. But those differences will cause a problem as the book goes on. When I think about it, I realize that we're never one or the other. We're in each of us, it's a mix of the modern and the ancient, things that we love about the old culture and things that absolutely drive us crazy about it. So we're a combination of that. And Kaurabi, especially as the book progresses and she discovers a secret, which we won't give away, but that secret is going to propel her to America. And she's going to start changing very rapidly once she's by herself alone in America, and not just any America, the America of 2002, post 9/11 America. So I think I am also that kind of combination of old and new. There are things that I love about our Indian traditions and things that I don't think are right. And the same with America. There's lots of things I love about being an American, being American, and there are things that I don't want to be a part of.
In 2002, the United States was grieving from 9/11. Oftentimes, this grief took ugly forms of personal attacks on brown-skinned people. India's western city of Godhra experienced a tragic time of communal violence between Hindu and Muslim communities. Chitra discussed weaving these events into her story of Oleander Girl.
Yeah, that was one of the other major themes of the book. I wanted to explore difference. How do we live with difference? And how important it is to live amicably with difference. because now we are this global world, we really pushed up against people who are not like us, much more than in the past when we could stay in our little groups in our home cities and never move. But now all around us are people who look different, who eat different foods, who follow a different religion, who wear different clothes, and more importantly, who think differently, whose ideologies are different. And when we come up in close contact with them, how are we to live in amity with this difference? So this book examines what happens when we don't, when we hate people just because they're different and we feel that they can be destroyed because being different, they're less human than we are. And that's, in a way, that's what leads to 9/11. In a way, that's what leads to the terrible Godhra riots, with the repercussions from which will go all across India and impact Rajat's family as well. In Oleander Girl, these issues are really important, but I had to make sure that they didn't come across as like preaching, because then that just destroys a novel. So these issues had to rise out of character. I mean, the events that happen in the world, but how they impact the characters in the book, that's really what was most important, how the characters feel in the book. And another really, a part of the story that became very interesting to me, because I hadn't planned on it, but it just kind of took on its own life, is the character of Asif, who is Rajat's family chauffeur. And his situation is interesting, particularly post-Godhra, because he's a Muslim driver in a Hindu family. And after Godhra, there's a lot of pressure on him to quit his job and not work for a Hindu.
And not support this staunchly Hindu family.
Not support them by working for them.
Right.
But on the other hand, he has developed a great affection for the daughter of the family, this little girl who reminds him of a sister that he had, who died when she was about the same age. And so, you know, here's the human connection, here's the political disconnect. How do you deal with something like that? I think that's the human story. That's what makes a novel interesting.
While pursuing her graduate studies, Chitra co-founded a domestic abuse shelter for South Asian women. She discussed the importance of having a shelter for this community, as well as how these issues manifest in the larger cultural perspective.
That's right. I was one of the co-founders of Maitri, which has now grown into a big and powerful and wonderful organization in the Bay Area. It was the first organization of its kind to help South Asian survivors of domestic violence or women who were trying to break out of domestic violence situations. And I think I just kind of came into it slowly. I started by working with the Women's Center on campus. Then I started volunteering at mainstream shelters. And then we realized the need of a South Asian shelter, because often these women are in such distress that they cannot go to a mainstream shelter. It's just too difficult for them. But a South Asian shelter, they feel more comfortable. They're more willing to come there for
culturally,
and they feel like they don't have to explain their whole culture when they go, on top of all of the trauma that they're facing. So yeah, and now I live in Houston and I'm on the advisory board of DIA, which is a similar organization. So working with women who have been in situations of domestic violence really made me realize how complex this problem is, particularly in the South Asian society, because it comes out of, I think, misunderstandings of what a woman's role is, how a woman should be treated. And there's often, you know, this kind of belief that a wife needs to put up with whatever her husband decides to, you know, hand out to her. And if she does anything against that, it will shame her family. And so these are some of the cultural issues that I have to work with. And all of us who are in the field of domestic violence prevention, we have to work with these. So I think this is connected to what Oleander Girl is about. Although this is not about domestic violence, it is about control. And the family secret that has been kept from Korubi all her life, part of the reason for keeping that secret is to control Korubi. part of the reason that secret occurred in the first place is because there was a desire to control another woman in the family. So I just thought that although on one level family secrets seem like, you know, it's a wonderful like plot device, really they come out of some very deep, deep-rooted problems in our thinking about women. I think that's so important to remember. I'm writing about violence against women in the South Asian context because that's the world I write about. But violence against women is a worldwide problem. It is something that, as thinking human beings, we need to consider. We need to consider and think about what we can do about it. A lot of people are very uncomfortable dealing with domestic violence and violence against women, rape, things like that. A lot of people just don't want to bring it up. And a lot of people get angry because some of my books deal with these issues of not just violence against women, but if you look at it from a positive angle, the empowerment of women, which will hopefully prevent such situations from happening. And not just the empowerment of women, but the consideration of a woman as a valuable human being who deserves to be treated decently, you know, decently with consideration. So a lot of people are just uncomfortable with that idea, but I figure as a writer, I just have to write about things that are important to me, that matter to me. So I've pretty much stopped caring what people will think. I just try to create a really good story with a strong character that people will care about. And my hope is, because that's happened to me as a reader, my hope is sometimes the books will change people's minds about how they believe, what they believe. Because sometimes we believe things because we don't know any better. We believe things because we haven't come across the truth of this issue. We've just heard about it. Or we've seen it from a very far distance. But a book really allows us to get into the minds and hearts of people in a very wonderful, inviting, and non-threatening way. So it's my belief that books change lives. Books have certainly changed my life.
Given the intense nature of the content and the lack of well-known South Asian American writers at the time, I did wonder how the South Asian American community reacted to her books.
When Arranged Marriage came out, which also deals with a lot of complex relationship and role issues, women who change after they come to the U.S., and Mistress of Spices has a character who is in a situation of domestic violence, and another character who is having major conflicts with her intergenerational family because she's chosen to marry outside of the Indian family. When these books came out, I think there was a lot of outcry in the South Asian American community because at that time there were not that many writers writing about the South Asian community, the South Asian American community, I should say. So this is, you know, mid-90s, okay. Mid-90s, right? So I think, you know, Bharati Mukherjee was there. There were many Asian writers, but there were not that many South Asian writers writing about the immigration experience. So there was a hue and cry. There was a sense of, oh, you're giving away our secrets, and now everybody will think we're not that model minority community. But I think people got over it because now the reaction is pretty positive. I think our community has also progressed. We are much more confident of ourselves. We feel that we have a place in America and we don't have to be a model minority anymore. We can be a rich, complex, diverse community.
In addition to Oleander Girl, Chitra also recently published her first children's book, Grandma and the Gourd, based on a folktale that she herself grew up hearing.
Yes, it has been such a pleasure to write this children's picture book. Grandma and the Great Gourd is written from a story my own grandfather used to tell me when I was little in India. He was to say this story to me in Bengali. It comes out of our oral tradition. So it was a great deal of fun just writing that story down, remembering the sounds, the he used to make, remembering like words out of my language, a lot of rhythm and rhyme and onomatopoeia. So, and it's one of, it's a very typical folk tale. It's kind of a hero's journey. One of the things I love about this story, which, you know, I've kept in its original form, is that the hero is a grandmother. Oh. Isn't that cool?
Which is really cool.
And she's going to undertake a dangerous journey through the forest to go see her daughter. And then she's going to come back through the forest. But there are all these animals waiting to eat her up. And grandma has to, like, use her wits and figure out how she can get out of this predicament. Thank you. Oh, I love being at KBOO. It reminds me of my student days at Berkeley. And I love Portland. My experience with Portland has been very positive. I think Portland is a city of readers, and I appreciate that.
That was award-winning author Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni. She recently published her latest novel, Oleander Girl, as well as a children's story, Grandma and the Gourd. You can keep up with her at her website, ChitraDivakaruni.com, and on Facebook at facebook.com/ChitraDivakaruni. I'm Sari Gametha, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO, 90.7 FM in Portland.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Yeh. Today we have C.P. Chang on the program. C.P. Chang is a writer, storyteller, and photographer. He's visiting Portland, Oregon from his Chicago home for this year's Wordstock Festival. So a big thank you to our Wordstock friends for bringing C.P. to town. C.P., welcome to APA Compass.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
C.P., could you introduce yourselves to our listeners?
My name is C.P. Chang. It stands for Chai Pei Chang. I'm a Chinese-American from the Midwest, born in Ohio, lived on the East Coast, lived on the West Coast, but Chicago has been my home on and off for the last 12 years, and it's my home right now.
So, C.P., you have a story about interracial relationships in the soon-to-be-released anthology, Briefly Knocked Unconscious by Low-Flying Duck. Could you tell us more about this book and how it came about?
This book is a product of the collective Second Story, which is this literary theatrical collective in Chicago. We tell stories in a first-person narrative about moments that changed our lives and moments that made us who we are. And we've been around for about 12 years, but this is the first time we've taken our live storytelling events and put them on paper.
How do you find the right people for your collective?
The folks that come to our collective are writers and are actors. And generally, it's folks that have come to see our previous shows or heard our podcasts. One of the things that we believe is that everybody has a story to tell. Everybody has an individual, unique human experience. And everybody can get up and sit in the chair and, with a little craft and a little coaching, both from the literary side as well as from the theatrical side, everyone can tell their story.
Could you tell us about your story and read us a portion?
When I was approached to write a story about my relationship with my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, Jess, who's African American, the story, which was supposed to be only 10 minutes long, became this 30-minute beginning of a memoir, because it's so complicated to talk about not only interracial relationships, but also your own race as it pertains to America. And I had a hard time being able to trim this down into a short segment. But with a lot of help, I was able to sort of craft this into a way that talked about what it was like for me being Chinese, what it was like to meet my girlfriend's family, who's black, who's from central Illinois, and how the two cultures mixed or didn't mix. All right, so this section picks up right after I meet Jess's grandmother for the first time. Jess's grandmother, on the other hand, was giddy over meeting me. Within an hour of my arrival, she offered to lend me her engagement ring. Jess had been afraid that her grandmother would say something ignorant, like asking me if I ate dogs. I would have cracked up if she'd asked that. I would have answered, dogs. No. It's best to get them when they're still puppies. Jess would have killed me. Now, to put this in context, I should tell you that whenever I talk to Jess about Chinese culture, I lie. She once asked me, how come you never wear your shoes in the apartment? And I told her, It's a Chinese thing. Another time she said to me, "Honey, you are crazy for your pork chops, aren't you?" And it's true. I love my pork chops and all things pork. Pork loins, breakfast sausage, bacon, pulled pork, barbecued pork ribs, bacon-wrapped pork chops, bacon-wrapped bacon. And I told her, it's a Chinese thing. When I was home alone one day, watching some girl-on-girl action on the internet, she came home early and almost caught me. I had to slam shut my laptop. She asked if I was watching porn, and I told her, for God's sakes, woman, it's a Chinese thing. Jess used to think that our racial joking was funny, but it got less funny when she met my parents. And suddenly, being able to distinguish my bull from the real thing was the difference between her getting along with my folks and totally insulting them by accident. Jess had been on me with questions. What's the difference between Chinese and Taiwanese? How does feng shui work? Chinese people don't really eat dogs, do they? It drives me crazy because for all my talk about it's a Chinese thing, I don't know crap. Just because my skin is Chinese doesn't mean I know all about it. Yes, I was born and raised in a Chinese family, but I grew up in a suburb near Columbus, Ohio, a place not exactly known for its bustling Chinatown or its melting pot of ethnicities. Until I was an adult, I didn't have any Chinese friends. I had a few black friends, some Jewish friends, and a good friend from India, but I didn't have any more cross-cultural experiences than your average white person. For most of my life, I went around trying to pass for white, and succeeding, because even though I'm Chinese, I sound totally white. Even with my Chinese name, I went by Chip when I bussed tables at Damon's as a teenager, and I've gone by my initials, CP, for so long that I don't even answer to my Chinese name anymore. As long as we're all being polite, I can pass for white, or so I think. But when I walk into a dive bar in Indiana, I feel like I can hear all the locals muttering, "Nah, fella, you ain't white." A few years ago, I started shooting pool at a bar in Lincoln Park, one of those places where you put your name on a chalkboard to get next on a pool table, and if you win, you keep the table until you get knocked off. These three other Chinese guys were always there, and this is one of those Lincoln Park bars where the only people of color there worked in the back. So one day, I walked over to these three other guys, looked at them, looked at all the other white people, and said, "Dudes, we gotta be over quota here. One of us Chinamen is gonna have to leave." We all cracked up, and after that, we became friends. We started going to bars and restaurants together and heading down to Chinatown for Chinese food, and it blew my mind that I could actually go to Chinatown with other people without feeling like I was a tour guide on a field trip, showing tourists all the exotic sights.
Is a lot of your work autobiographical?
The work that we do at Second Story is generally autobiographical, and it's really the only place where I write about being Chinese. I started my writing career as a fiction writer, and in all the short stories that I wrote, folks were white by default. And then I started being more thoughtful about race and culture and started writing at first about black people. and even then, I couldn't figure out how to write about Chinese people. What happened is that by writing about my own experience and realizing that I didn't have to write about all Chinese people or all Asian Americans, I just had to write about what my experience was like.
When someone tells a story, the telling might change depending on who the audience is. So who do you see as the audience for your stories?
That's a really great question. As you might have heard from the story, my wife is black, and we both talk about this. And the honest truth is that we both write to talk to folks who don't know what we know, to talk to white audiences and say, this is what it's like to be a minority in America, or this is what it's like to be in an interracial relationship. And the truth of the matter is that our stories would change if I were talking to an audience of all Asian Americans, or if we were talking to an audience of all interracial couples, because there's a different kind of connection. One of the really interesting things about writing as well as telling stories is that you're both making a connection with your audience, but you're trying to tell them something new, something that's important to you, something that they haven't heard before. And it changes a little bit depending on who the audience is. What we can do is just sort of write the story and hope that it connects to the audience, whoever they are.
How about some of the differences? Could you give us some examples of maybe how you would change things depending on who the audience is?
Yeah, one of the things that always happens in writing is writing to people who don't know what you know. And so in my story, I talk about these three guys that I met in the bar. And we laugh and joke about the same things because they're also first-generation Chinese kids. They also went to Chinese school. They also fought with their parents about whether they were going to play the piano or learn Chinese. And we connected over that. But as a writer, I have to put these things on the page. And so I have to imagine that I'm talking to somebody who doesn't know about any of that. And then if they do know about it, it's a bonus. It's like being able to be on the inside of this story or this joke because you're like, I recognize myself in that. So those are the types of things. If I'm writing the story to one of my friends from this bar, I can shorthand a lot of it because they understand the jokes already. So I have to think about, don't shorthand the joke, okay? Actually put it on the page and actually explain what's happening as if this person has no idea what you're talking about.
So CP, what sort of feedback do you receive from your audiences?
Oh, it's all sorts of different feedback. Like this particular story, it's been interesting. I've had couples come up to me who are maybe one person in the couple is white and the other person is Latino, or black and Latino. All sorts of folks from different interracial relationships come up to me and say, we identify with your story. And that's one of the things that we as Second Story really subscribe to, is that even though all of our stories are personal narratives, are autobiographical, in the craft, you hope that your stories reach a universal experience. That just because I'm Chinese American and my wife is black doesn't mean you can't be a white couple, basically, that has the same kind of experiences of how do we navigate another family? How do we navigate our pasts in our present relationship? And so that's the issue of craft. How do we make the story universal so that anyone can respond to it? And I've had all sorts of response from the audience that say, I don't have to be Asian American to get your story. I get your story as a white woman living on the south side of Chicago.
So any relationship has its fair share of pressures, and interracial relationships seem to have an extra layer of that. Why is that, do you think, and what can be done to improve things?
I think that a lot of what it boils down to is the fact that race is such an important thing in America that it is hard to shed that aspect. My wife, who's black, says there's not a day that goes by that she doesn't remember she's black. We live in a world of many different races, but in America, at least, it's still a predominantly white culture. And so we can't forget our own race, and it becomes really embedded into our identity. And so when we get into a relationship with another person who is of a different race, then we have to navigate our own identities in that context. Ideally, you want your partner to know every part of you, and having this thing, this racial identity that can be a barrier sometimes, be part of this relationship, it's almost like a third person in the relationship to navigate. And obviously, having a third person in the relationship is a pretty complicated thing.
Okay. So when you're young, what did you think you wanted to do?
I, believe it or not, I always knew I wanted to be a writer since I was 12. I wanted to tell stories, and I was so interested in language. And I bet you a lot of the other Asian American listeners out there will identify with this, my father and I had a drag-down knockout fight about what I was going to major in college. So I majored in math. Because the question was, what are you going to do with your degree? And he was right in some sense in that I got out of college, I got a job in the software industry, I paid back my bills, I paid my debts, and it got me a chance to pursue writing on the side. But it's been a long road, and I almost fell out of my chair one day recently when my parents were like, well, maybe we should have let you become a writer earlier, because they realized this is a thing that I always wanted to do, is to be able to talk to the world about all the interesting things about what it means to be a human being in the world. When I was young, I wanted to be able to talk about what it felt like to be scared of your father or proud of your brother or sad about a relationship that didn't work out. And those words are so inadequate to simply say sad or proud or happy, because if I want to say exactly what I mean, I need a lot more words to talk about what it's like to be scared of your own father. And that's when I started writing. I said, in order for me to talk about what this feeling is, I need to tell you an entire story. I need to give you an example of this boy and his father and the house that they grew up in and his school and his friends, because that's the only way that I can tell you what I really mean when I use this one word, scared. And that's how I started writing.
Who were your role models or heroes?
there are so many great, brave writers out in the world, and one of them right now that I'm really amazed by is Junot Diaz. Junot Diaz, Dominican writer from the DR, he writes so intelligently and so bravely about race in America. Even though he's not Asian American, I would recommend for any Asian American writer listening that wants to read about how to write as an Asian American, read about other races and how they talk about it. And Junot Diaz, with his short story collection Drown and with his book The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, does such an amazing job about writing what it's like to be on the outside in America. Even Ralph Ellison, with his famous book The Invisible Man, which is seemingly strictly about the experience of a black American, resonated with me so deeply because it's really about what it's like to not be seen for who you are. And as an Asian American who walks around in a predominantly white culture in America, I'm sometimes seen as white, I'm sometimes seen as not white, but I don't always know that I'm seen as me. And so that book just really blew my mind.
Could you give our listeners some contact information?
You can check us out at www.secondstory.com. You can listen to our podcast there. You can read some of our stories there. And you can order our book there.
CP, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
We've been chatting with author, poet, and storyteller CP Chang. My name is Andrew Ye, and you're listening to APA Compass.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to APA Compass. Coming up next, APA Compass contributor Marie Lowe speaks with novelist Ruth Ozeki, whose latest book, A Tale for the Time Being, has just been released by Viking Press.
So I just wanted to congratulate you on the wonderful praise and acclaim your book has received. And yeah, it was really, really powerful and moving. And A Tale for the Time Being is so broad and encompassing in that it connects Zen Buddhism, physics and quantum mechanics and the crisis of bullying, but also in connection to these issues of life and death, these broad questions, and then, of course, the tsunami and the earthquake in Japan. So it's a real difficult novel to describe because it spans and contains so many different elements. I mean, it spans time, it spans geography, it spans voices and languages and worlds. So given how huge and broad it is, I love how you focused these issues and themes through this kind of relationship between now, the 16-year-old girl who writes a diary and chronicles the life of her great-grandmother, who is a Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist nun, and then, of course, the other character is Ruth, this writer, who discovers Now's diary, which has washed ashore off of an island off of British Columbia. So I'm so curious to hear more about the inspiration behind A Tale for the Time Being.
Yeah, you know, I think it's hard to pinpoint just one inspiration because as I was writing it, just all of the things that I've been thinking about for the past decade ended up circling around in the kind of gyre of my mind and winding up in the book. But I think most specifically, the first inkling I had in 2006 that I had a book was when I first heard Now's first lines. Okay, and she kind of announced herself and she said, "Hi, my name is Now, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you." And that was the first, you know, those lines kind of came into my head, and I wrote them down, and I knew a bunch of things about this girl. I knew that she was Japanese, but for some reason she was writing in English. So that was kind of a mystery to me. I knew she was about 14, 15, 16 years old, wasn't quite sure. I knew that she was writing. You know, I knew that she was writing a diary, but for some reason she was writing this diary to somebody. Right? She was writing this diary and addressing somebody, some reader out there who she didn't know that much about, but she was confident that by writing this, that, you know, that she could cast her words out into the world and that it would find the reader. Okay. So these were the kinds of things that I knew in my mind. But, you know, but then it was a kind of a search after that to find out, you know, well, who is she talking to and what are the circumstances of her life? And if there is a reader out there, you know, who is that reader and what's their relationship and all of these different kinds of things. So I think that, you know, that was the first inkling I had that there was a book here. But the fundamental, I suppose, inspiration for the book came with this notion of time being, right? And that came from a 13th century Zen Buddhist, Zen master mm-hmm. named Dogen Zenji. And it was from a fascicle, an essay that he wrote called Uji, which can be translated as time being or being time or for the time being. And so I was reading his essays on time and his philosophy on time and had been studying that for several years. And I think it, you know, that's really what kind of inspired this inspired, you know, the heart of the book, which is really about time. I mean, it's about what it says it's about, time and being.
Right. Great. Well, it's so interesting that you were saying, you know, you had this voice and you mm-hmm. had and you were trying to imagine this writer speaking to a reader. But that reader is a writer in
yes.
the sense in the novel, because that writer is, you know, quote unquote, you in some sense, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the character Ruth shares a lot of
yes.
autobiographical similarities. And so how, you know, what about that relationship, you know, writing to a writer who is also a reader, who is the writer who has written herself in as a character?
That was perfect. That was a perfect way to describe it. So when I first heard Now's voice and realized that she was talking to somebody, I, of course, thought she must be talking to me, right? And so I thought, this was back in 2006, I thought, well, maybe I'm the reader. Maybe I'm the, you know, the character of the reader. Mm-hmm. I should put myself in the book. And I immediately discarded that. It just seemed like a terrible idea. It seemed so uncomfortably metafictional, uh-huh. you know, postmodern for all of the wrong reasons, you know, self-conscious kind of, yeah, just not, I wasn't comfortable with it at all. And so I then proceeded to kind of audition other characters
oh, wow.
for that role of the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have rewritten the book about four or five times,
oh.
each time with a different character.
So who are some of the characters?
some of them were young, some of them were old, some of them were male, some of them were female. One of the characters, I actually managed to make, to write an entire version of the book with a character who had no gender and who had no age and who had no name. And I never once used a definite article during the entire...
Wow.
Yeah. It was terrible. It was a disaster, right?
Because... Yeah.
Well, it just, you know, there was nobody there, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And every time I tried to find the character of the reader, I just wasn't able to do it. And so as a result, I mean, I've given up on this book many times over the course of the years. I just thought it was not writable.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, I guess it was in the beginning of 2011, I did finish a draft. You know, I made it to the end of a book. And I realized I couldn't go any further with it on my own, and mm-hmm. I wanted editorial help. So I'd given it to my agent, who was about to submit it to my editor, when and this was in March of 2011, when the earthquake, the Tohoku earthquake hit,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, followed by the tsunami and the meltdown at Fukushima. And I realized that, you know, that the book that I'd written, the draft of the book that I'd written was just completely irrelevant because, you know, Japan had changed. Japan mm-hmm. was now a different place. The world was a different place. Everything was different. So, you know, I quickly just withdrew the book from submission. And then, you know, it sat around for a couple of months. And then finally I got back to it. And I realized at that time that once again I had the reader character wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so I unzipped, you know, I unzipped the book and threw half of it away. And started once again, but this time putting myself back in as the character of Ruth, who, as you point out, is she's a fictionalized version of me, but, you know, she's pretty close to me in many ways, right? And it enabled me to really respond in a much more direct and straightforward way to the events in that post-Fukushima, post-earthquake world.
Huh. This is actually sort of leading to my next question that I had wanted to ask you about. There's a line in A Tale for the Time Being that I really love, which you write, right into being. And this was when Ruth is thinking, well, did Now write me into being? Yeah. And it seemed like this idea of right into being is something that, is very explicit in this novel, but also seems to be a kind of recurring theme in a lot of your works.
You know, the way that I thought about the Now character in particular is that she, you know, she writes Ruth into being, right? And that is the relationship that characters have with novelists, right? Without the character calling to the novelist, then the novelist doesn't exist.
Right, a novelist.
As a novelist, that's right. And so in this case, the character of Now, you know, is kind of swimming around out there in some great Pirandellian soup, you know, and spots this novelist, this unsuspecting novelist, you know, on a remote island in British Columbia, and says, I think I like that one, and, you know, descends and then proceeds to kind of parasitize my mind, you know, for the years that it takes to write the book. Right? But I think that's how books work, too, you know, that books call readers into being in the same kind of way. Every relationship with, you know, between a writer and a reader is a relationship that's essentially collaborative. You know, I can write a book, but the book doesn't exist until it's read, right? Mm-hmm. And so the book that, you know, that you and I create together is going to be very different from the book that another reader, you know, and I will create together. So it's a collaboration in the truest sense of the word.
It sounds also in terms of exploring the relationship between reader and writer or novelist or artist, filmmaker, this kind of collaboration produces some other world that seems to not exist or seems to enable a kind of bridging between different languages, different historical periods, different geographies.
And
this is coming from an Asian American academic perspective, perhaps. And I found that really, really powerful as a way to think about, well, identity and community beyond the identity politic that led to the formation of an Asian American literary canon, what counts as an Asian American text. And it really broadens that category.
I think that this idea of bridging is something that, certainly for me, you know, I'm mixed race. And so as a Hapa writer and as a Hapa person, I mean, from the time I was very, very little, I was always very aware that I was neither here nor there. And that somehow everything that I've done creatively in my life has been about bridging, has been about, you know, moving from one side to the other. So I think that this, you know, this idea of a kind of non-dualistic thought, it's kind of in my DNA, you know.
Right.
And so I've always been writing, I think, from that perspective. But the other thing I was interested in was, and you know, this ties back to, you know, Asian literary history, was I was fascinated by the Japanese genre of fiction called the I novel, the watashi shosetsu. And this was a genre of fiction that was very popular in the Taisho period, in the early 1900s. And it was Japanese fiction writers were kind of entranced with, you know, their exposure to, you know, these notions of, you know, Western identity and Western, you know, individuality, something that there wasn't much of in Japan during the feudal, the hundreds of years of Japanese feudalism. And so they, you know, they were having their first exposure to this notion of, you know, a person as an individual with an identity like that. And so they were starting to experiment with this and put themselves in their fictions, right? And so this was something also that really intrigued me, because I thought that would be a kind of an interesting way on, you know, of commenting on this old genre.
You already mentioned that, you know, you had written different drafts between All Over Creation and A Tale for the Time Being. What other things took place during that 10-year period between these two books?
Well, there was a lot going on. See, now, All Over Creation was published in 2003. And during that time, I was, actually since 1998, I was taking care of my mom, who had Alzheimer's. And so that was really the center of my life, taking care of her. You know, talk about time. You know, I was very, very aware of time. I was aware that we are time beings with a time limit. You know, I had buried my father in 1998 and lost my mom in 2004. So, you know, this was really the focus of my life and my thinking around that time. You know, I was really trying to understand what it means to be a being with a time limit. And so, of course, that turns to Zen. You know, Zen practice is a very good practice to use when you're contemplating life and death. And so during that time, I was studying Zen, and I was working with a Zen teacher. I still am. And I was sitting a lot of Zazen. I was sitting a lot of Zen meditation. And I was also reading a lot of Zen texts. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think all of those ended up finding their way into the book. And then in 2010, I was ordained as a Zen priest. I'm just sort of starting out as a Zen priest. I'm kind of a baby priest right now. But this is a hugely important part of my life. I mean, I think in a way it's different from being a novelist, but it's also the same. So I think both my writing and my Zen practice are coming from very much the same place.
And can you say a little bit more about that? I mean, how does your Zen practice relate to the writing practice?
Well, I think it relates in a number of ways. Some of them are very practical. You know, Zen is very practical. You know, one of the things that you know, you spend a lot of time in Zen meditating. And I think that writing, too, is a contemplative practice. So I think that actually these two things support each other in wonderful ways. One of the things that, you know, in Zen we talk about Zazen or Zen meditation as a practice of return, so that you have an object of meditation, which is usually the breath, when you're starting out, and your mind is constantly sort of spinning out, you know, and usually your mind is time traveling. You know, you time travel into the past, thinking about something you said the other day that is still plaguing you, or an email that you sent that you shouldn't, or, you know, and so then your mind goes spinning off into the past, or it goes spinning off into the future. You know, what should I have for dinner tonight? You know, all of these kinds of things. And so the practice of Zazen is really just to return to the present moment. You know, it's not wrong for your mind to go spinning off. It's just, I mean, that's what minds do. They think, right? But the idea is just that you catch it and then you return, right? And this is a very, very useful practice if you're a writer. I think Zazen really helps you, you know, helps me as a writer develop a kind of patience and a kind of faith and an ability to continually come back, even when you think you're screwing up terribly, you know?
Well, before you became a writer, you were also a filmmaker, and I read that you had also worked as, I think, a set designer and artistic director on horror films. Can you talk a little bit about your early sort of work in film and then how that transitioned into becoming a novelist?
You know, I should preface that, though, just by saying that, you know, I remember when I was a little kid, you know, maybe in, you know, third grade, realizing that I wanted to be a writer. You know, and I always wrote and I always read. I was a voracious reader. I knew that I wanted to be a novelist pretty early on, even probably before I knew quite what a novel was. I wanted to write books. And then, you know, I wrote all the way through high school and college. I think I was a little bit secretive about it. I didn't, you know, I was scared of it. Mm-hmm. And then after college, I ended up going into, I took an academic route and studied classical Japanese and was thinking about doing comp lit. And then somehow just got derailed from that and ended up, you know, moving back to New York and getting involved in the film business. I had friends who were in the film business and they were working on, at that point, low budget films in New York, and many of those films were horror films. This was right at the beginning of, it seems like so long ago. It was at the beginning of videotape. VHS, right? Beta, right? And you know, home video was like a big deal. People were getting, you know, VCRs, you know, and putting them, you know, hooking them up to their televisions, and you know, and so suddenly there was this need for content. You know, they needed, you know, people needed movies in order to use the new technology to sell it. And so there was this whole spate of low budget films that were being produced that went directly to video, never, you know, bypassed the theaters and went directly to video. And so I fell into that market I think the first film I art directed was called Matt Riker Mutant Hunt. And then the second one was called Breeders. And others were Necropolis, Robot Holocaust. You know, it just went from bad to worse. I'm always terrified that somebody's actually seen these, you know, which would be very unfortunate. And so I did that for years, for several years. And then, but at that point I could speak Japanese. You know, mm-hmm. I'd been living in Japan and I spoke Japanese. And I sort of fell into this little niche market, doing production work, facilitation, coordination mm-hmm. for Japanese film shoots that were happening in New York, making commercials, you know, making television, that kind of thing. And little by little, I started doing more television. I started doing some writing for television. I started doing some directing. And finally, I started doing some editing. And that's when I started to, that's when I really learned how to tell stories,
through editing.
And it was really through making television that I learned how to write, you know, a novel. I learned how to move a story, you know, quickly and efficiently through time.
Interesting.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And then you did this film, Having the Bones, which is beautiful.
Yes, thank you. And I'm happy to say that it's available for download on iTunes. Yeah, that was a film I made, you know, I made it in 1990. I think I started it in 93, something mm-hmm. like that, finished it. And it did, you know, it did very well for a very small, you know, very personal, you know, very sort of contemplative film.
Right.
It went to Sundance and was in a documentary competition at Sundance. And that felt like a huge triumph. It's a film about my mom mm-hmm. and about my grandmother. So it's a very personal little right. film. I made most of it myself with help from a friend of mine who is a wonderful cinematographer. And I remember going to Sundance with it, you know, and everybody else had these huge entourages, right? Mm-hmm. And I was there kind of by myself with my little roll of posters, right? And God, I think about it now. I went to my first screening, and it was at a duplex theater in Park City. And the bus pulled up, and it was snowing very heavily. And I got off the bus, and I looked across the street, and I saw these big film lights, and I saw television crews, and I saw lines around the block. And, you know, there was just all of this excitement. I looked up there in lights, you know, it said Ruth Ozeki Having the Bones. And I thought, oh my God, I have made it, you know, I have made it. And I crossed the street, you know, kind of through this blinding snow. And then I realized that, that all of the lines and the television and the lights were all for a boxing film documentary. So it was very funny because there on one side of the marquee is, I think it was Muhammad Ali, and on the other side of the marquee is my mom, you know. Well, Muhammad Ali and mom, like up there in lights. It was great. It was a wonderful experience, but it was very funny.
So was it with that experience that you then decided that you were going to direct your attention and energies to writing a novel? Or, you know, what was that transition? How did you transition?
The transition happened pretty naturally. I made two films, mm-hmm. and by the end of making two films, I had maxed out my credit cards, and I basically couldn't afford to make another film. You know, the films did well critically, but, you know, they're not Rumble in the Jungle, you know.
Right.
So it suddenly occurred to me that you can write a novel for the cost of a ream of paper. And so that was a wonderfully kind of liberating moment. So I started writing my Year of Meats. And I realized, too, that, you know, once I actually started getting into the writing process, I had this feeling of coming home. You know, this is what I've always wanted to do. Now's the time to do it. I was 40 years old at the time. And I remember rushing to finish so that I could print out a draft of the novel on the eve of my 41st birthday so that I could honestly say that I had finished my first novel by the time I was 40. You know?
So what's next for you? What's your next project on the horizon?
What's next? You know, I mentioned that there were these characters who didn't quite make the cut.
Right.
Right. I auditioned them for the role of the reader in A Tale for the Time Being, but they didn't quite make the cut. And some of them are feeling quite rejected, you know, and they are feeling like they just did not get their moment in the sun. And so they are staging a comeback, I think. And it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But I think, you know, I have some ideas for another, you know, for the next novel. And we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, well, thank you.
Giving us your time.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Ruth Ozeki's latest novel, A Tale for the Time Being, has just been released by Viking Press, and don't forget that her 1996 film, Having the Bones, is available for download on iTunes.
Thanks for tuning into APA Compass this morning. We want to say a special thank you to authors Chitra Banerjee Divakarani, C.P. Chang, and Ruth Ozeki for joining us today. Tune in to APA Compass the first Friday of every month at 9 a.m. here on KBOO Community Radio. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for a story, or an angry APA Minute, you can connect with us through our Facebook account. Archives of past shows are at apacompass.wordpress.com. Today's program was produced by Marie Lowe, Sarika Mehta, Kushlani D'Souza, and Andrew Ye. Thank you for listening to APA Compass.
All of this traces back to Magna Carta 800 years ago. Magna Carta had two components. One is the Charter of Liberties, the famous one, which I discussed, the foundation of Anglo-American law, now being torn to shreds before our eyes. The other part is what was called the Charter of Forests. Now, that was dedicated to protection of the commons from the ravages of the power centers of the day.
That's Noam Chomsky, Magna Carta, Then and Now, on the next Alternative Radio. Tune into Alternative Radio this Tuesday at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
Dance companies and orchestras around the world are celebrating the 100th anniversary of Igor Stravinsky's masterpiece, The Rite of Spring. Here in Portland, new choreography to Stravinsky's score will be performed by the Agnieszka Laska Dancers in collaboration with the PSU Orchestra under the direction of Ken Selden. The performance of The Rite of Spring will take place Friday, June 7th at 8